The stifling heat was past now, and the air smelled faintly of the dusty end of summer. The Tullish plain was dotted with villages, random collections of thatch-roofed cottages and dirt streets. The villagers watched, sullen and afraid, as the priests of Torak rode through the little towns, their faces cold and aloof. The plain to the west of Tolzelek was covered with the red tents of the vast staging area that had been erected for the Malorian army. With the exception of caretaker detachments, however, the huge camp was empty. The troops already in Mishrak Achtul were with Zakath near Tol Mardu, and the steady stream of new arrivals had been quite suddenly cut off. Tolzelek itself was like any port town in the world, smelling of salt water, fish, tar, and rotting seaweed. The gray stone buildings were low and squat, almost like the Tulls themselves, and the cobblestone streets all sloped down toward the harbor, which lay in the curve of a broad estuary, and faced a somewhat similar harbor on the other side.
"What city is that?"
Tinedra curiously asked of one of the Grolems, as she looked across the dirty water toward the far shore.
"Yarmarak,"
the black-robed priest answered curtly.
"Ah,"
she said, remembering now her tedious geography lessons. The two cities, one Tullish, the other Nadrak, faced each other across the estuary at the mouth of the river Kordu, and the boundary between Mishrak Akhtal and Garag Nadrak ran down the precise center of the river.
"When the Emperor returns from Tol Mardu, I imagine that he will take steps to eradicate that place over there," one of the Grolems added. "He was not pleased with the behavior of the King of Drosta on the battlefield, and some chastisement seems to be in order."
They proceeded directly down a cobbled avenue to the harbor, where but a few ships were moored to the wharves.
"My crew absolutely refuses to put to sea," the Malorian captain of the ship upon which they were to embark reported to the Grolems. "The Kereks out there are like a pack of wolves, burning and sinking everything afloat."
"The Kerek fleet is farther south,"
the priest in charge of the detachment of Grolems declared.
"The Kerek fleet is everywhere, revered priest,"
the captain disagreed.
2 days ago they burned 4 coastal towns, 200 leagues to the south of here, and yesterday they sank 12 ships, 100 leagues to the north. You would not believe how fast they can move. They do not even take the time to loot the towns that they are burning."
He shuddered.
"They are not men. They are a natural disaster."
"We will set sail within the hour,"
the Grolem insisted.
"Not unless your priests know how to man the oars and handle the rigging,"
the captain told him.
"My men are terrified. They won't sail."
"We will convince them,"
the Grolem said darkly. He gave a few orders to his under-priests. An altar was quickly erected on the high stern deck, and a brazier filled with glowing coals placed to one side of it. The leader of the Grolems took his place at the altar and began chanting in a deep, hollow voice, his arms raised to the sky. In his right hand he held a gleaming knife. At random, his cohorts selected a sailor and dragged him, screaming and struggling, to the stern deck. As Tzenedra watched with horror, he was bent backward across the altar and butchered with an almost casual efficiency. The Grolem, who had wielded the knife, lifted the dead man's dripping heart.
"Behold our offering, Dragon God of Angarak!"
he cried in a great voice, then turned and deposited the heart in the smoking brazier. The heart steamed and sizzled horribly for a moment, then began to blacken and shrivel as the fire consumed it. From the bow of the ship a gong clanged in iron celebration of the sacrifice. The Grolem, at the altar, his bloody hands dripping, turned to confront the ashen-faced sailors crowded amidships.
"Our ceremonies will continue until the ship sails," he told them. "Who will be the next to give his heart
to our beloved god.
The ship set sail immediately. Tenedra, sick with revulsion, turned her face away. She looked at Polgara, whose eyes burned with hatred, and who seemed in the grip of an overpowering interior struggle. Tenedra knew her, and she knew that it was only by a tremendous effort of her will that Polgara was able to keep herself from unleashing a terrible retribution on the blood-stained Grolem at the altar. Beside her, protected in the clasp of one of her arms, stood Erand. On the child's face was an expression Tenedra had never seen there before. His look was sad, compassionate, and, at the same time, filled with a kind of iron-hard resolution, as if, had he but the power, he would destroy every altar to Torak in all the world.
"You will go below decks now?"
one of their Grolem captors told them.
"It will be a matter of some days before we reach the shores of boundless Meloria."
They sailed north, hugging the Nadrak coastline, fearfully ready to run for any beach that offered itself should Kerak ships appear on the horizon. At a certain point, the Melorian captain peered about at the empty sea, swallowed hard, and swung his tiller over for the quick, terrified dash across open water to the east. Once, a day or more out from the Nadrak coast, they saw a dreadful column of thick black smoke rising far to the south, and a day or so farther on they sailed through a sea littered with charred debris, where bodies, pale and bloated, bobbed in the dark waves of the eastern sea. The frightened sailors pulled their oars with all their strength, not even needing the encouragement of whips to row faster. Then, one murky morning when the sky behind them threatened rain squalls and the air was oppressively heavy with the advancing storm, a low, dark smudge appeared on the horizon ahead of them, and the sailors doubled their efforts, rushing desperately toward the safety of the Melorian coast ahead. The beach upon which the small boats from their ship landed them was a sloping shingle of dark, salt-encrusted gravel where the waves made a strange, mournful sighing as they receded. Awaiting them some distance up from the water's edge sat a mounted party of Grolems, their black robes belted at the waist with crimson sashes.
"Archpriests," Polgara noted coldly. "We are to be escorted with some ceremony, I take it."
The Grolem who had commanded their escort went quickly up the gravel stand toward the waiting group and prostrated himself before them, speaking with a hushed reverence. One of the archpriests, an aged man with deeply lined face and sunken eyes, dismounted rather stiffly and came down to where Tenedra and her friends had just stepped from the small boat.
"My queen,"
he said to Polgara, bowing respectfully.
"I am Urdag, archpriest of the district of Kamat. I am here with my brethren to escort you to the City of Night."
"I am disappointed not to find Zadar waiting," the sorceress replied coldly. "I trust that he's not indisposed."
Urdag gave her a quick look of irritation.
"Do not rail against your foreordained fate, Queen of Angarak," he advised her.
"I have two fates awaiting me, Urdag. Which one I will follow has not yet been decided."
"I do not have any doubts about the matter," he declared.
"That's probably because you have never dared to look at the alternatives," she replied. "Shall we go, Urdag? A windy beach is hardly the place for philosophical discussion."
The Grolem archpriests had brought horses with them, and the party was soon mounted and riding away from the sea, across a line of low wooded hills in a generally northeasterly direction. The trees bordering the upper edge of the gravel beach had been dark-boughed spruces, but once they topped the first rise, they entered a vast forest of white-barked aspens. To Tenedra's eyes, the stark white trunks looked almost corpse-like. and the entire forest had a gloomy, unhealthy quality about it.
"Mistress Paul,"
Durnick said in a voice that was scarcely more than a whisper,
"shouldn't we be working on some kind of plan?"
"For what, Durnick?"
"For our escape, of course."
"But we don't want to escape, Durnick."
"We don't?"
"The Grolems are taking us to the place we want to go."
"Why do we want to go to this Tol Mishrek of theirs, then?"
"We have something to do there."
"From everything I've heard, it's a bad sort of place," he told her. "Are you sure you haven't made some mistake?"
She reached out and laid her hand on his arm.
"Dear Durnick, you will just have to trust me."
"Of course, Mistress Paul," he replied immediately. "But shouldn't I know what to expect? If I should have to take steps to protect you, I ought to be prepared."
"I'd tell you if I knew, Durnick. But I don't know what we should expect. All I know is that the four of us are supposed to go to Tol Mishrek. What's going to happen there needs us in order for it to be complete. Each of us has something to do there."
"Even me?"
"Especially you, Durnick. At first I did not understand who you really are. That's why I tried to keep you from coming along, but now I do understand. You have to be there because you are going to do the one thing that's going to turn the entire outcome one way or the other."
"What is it?"
"We don't know."
His eyes grew wide.
"What if I do it wrong?" he asked in a worried voice.
"I don't think you can," she assured him. "From everything I understand, what you are going to do will flow very naturally out of who and what you are."
She gave him a brief, wry little smile.
"You won't be able to do it wrong, Durnick, any more than you would be able to lie or cheat or steal. It's built into you to do it right. So don't worry about it."
"Well, that's all very well for you to say, Mistress Paul," he replied. "But if you don't mind, I will worry about it just a little bit, privately, of course."
She laughed then, a little, a fond little laugh.
"You dear, dear man," she said impulsively, taking his hand. "Whatever would we do without you?"
Durnick blushed and tried to look away, but her glorious eyes held his, and he blushed even more. After they had passed through the forest of aspen, they entered a strangely desolate landscape. White boulders stuck up out of tangled weeds like tombstones in a long-abandoned graveyard, and dead trees thrust their crooked limbs at the overcast sky like pleading fingers. The horizon ahead was covered with a bank of darker cloud, a cloud so intensely black that it seemed almost purple.
Oddly, Tenedra noted,
the cloud bank did not seem to be moving at all. There was no sign anywhere of any human habitation, and the route they followed was not even marked by a trail.
"Does no one live there?"
the princess asked Folgera.
"Tol Mishrek is deserted, except for a few Grolems," the sorceress replied. "Torak smashed the city and drove its people out the day my father and King Kerak and his son stole the orb back from the Iron Tower."
"When was that?"
"A very long time ago, Tenedra. As nearly as we have been able to determine, it was precisely on the same day that Beldurand and I were born, and the day our mother died. It's a bit hard to say for sure. We were a bit casual about keeping track of time in those days."
"If your mother had died and Belgorath was here, well, who took care of you?"
"Belden, of course,"
Polgara smiled.
"Oh, he wasn't a very good mother, but he did the best that he could until father returned."
"Is that why you're so fond of him?"
"One of the reasons, yes."
The ominous cloud bank still did not move. It stretched across the sky as stationary as a range of mountains. As they rode toward it, it loomed higher and higher.
"That's a very strange cloud," Durnick noted,
looking speculatively at the thick curtain of purple ahead.
"The storm's coming in behind us. That cloud doesn't seem to be moving at all."
"It does not move, Durnick. It never has moved. When the Angaraks built Tol Mishrak, Torak put that cloud there to hide the city. It has been there ever since.
How long's that?
About 5,000 years.
The sun never shines there.
Never. The Grolom archpriest had begun to look about with a certain apprehension, and finally Urtag called a halt.
We must make ourselves known, he declared. We do not want the watchers to mistake us for intruders.
The other archpriests nodded nervously, and then all removed polished steel masks from beneath their robes and carefully covered their faces with them. Then each of them untied a thick torch from his saddle and ignited it with a brief, mumbled incantation. The torches burned with a peculiarly green-tinged flame and gave off a reeking, sulphurous smoke.
"I wonder what would happen if I were to blow out your torches,"
Polgara suggested, with a hint of mischievous smile on her face.
"I could, you know."
Urtag gave her a worried look.
"This is no time for foolishness, my lady," he warned her. "The Watchers are very savage with intruders. Our lives depend on these torches. Please, don't do anything to bring down a disaster on us all."
She laughed lightly and let it go at that. As they rode in beneath the cloud, it grew steadily darker. It was not precisely the clean darkness of night, but was rather a kind of dirty murkiness, a deep shade hovering in the air. They crested a rise and saw before them a cloud-enshrouded basin, and in its center, half obscured by the pervasive gloom, stood the ravaged city of night. The vegetation around them had shrunk to a few sparse weeds, and an unhealthy-looking stunted grass, pale and sick for want of sun. The boulders thrusting up out of the earth were splotched with a sort of leprous lichen that ate into the rock itself, and nodules of a white fungus lumped in grotesque profusion, spreading out across the dank soil as if the ground itself were diseased. With a slow, careful pace, their sputtering torches held above their heads, the Grolom archpriests led the way down into the gloomy basin and across the unwholesome plain toward the shattered walls of Ktol Mishrak. As they entered the city, the princess saw furtive hints of movement among the tumbled stones. Shadowy forms scurried from place to place among the ruins, and the sound of their movements was the clicking scrape made by creatures whose feet were clawed. Some of the shapes were upright, others were not. Tenedra grew cold and afraid. The watchers of Ktol Mishrak were neither beast nor human, and they seemed to exude a kind of indiscriminate malice toward all other living things. More than anything, she was afraid that one of them might suddenly turn and confront her with a face that might rip away her sanity by its hideousness. As they passed down a broken street, Urtag began to intone an ancient prayer to Torak, his voice hollow and shaking. The dank air grew colder, and the disease-like lichen ate at the tumbled stones of the ruined houses. Mold seemed to cling to everything, and the pale fungus grew in grotesque lumps in corners and crannies. The smell of decay was everywhere, a damp, rotten stench, and slimy pools of stagnant water lay among the ruins. In the center of the city stood the rusted stump of a vast iron tower, the broken-off girders which had supported it thicker than a man's waist. Just to the south of the stump lay a broad, rusted trail of total destruction where the tower had fallen, crushing everything beneath it. Over the aeons, the iron had rusted down into a sort of damp red mud that outlined the enormous dimensions of the fallen structure. The stump had eroded down, the years rounding off the corners and broken edges. The rust mingled in places with a kind of thick black ooze that ran down the faces of the iron plates like gobbets of clotted blood. Urtag, trembling visibly now, dismounted before a vast arched portal and led them through a half-open iron door. The echoing chamber they entered was as large as the imperial throne room in Tolhanath. wordlessly, his torch held high over his head. Urtag led them across the pitted floor to another iron-arched doorway, and then down a flight of clanging iron steps that reached into the darkness beneath. At the bottom of the stairs, perhaps 50 feet below the wreckage above, stood another door of black iron, studded with great round rivet heads. Hesitantly, Urtag rapped his knuckles on the door, and the sound of his rapping echoed hollowly in the chamber beyond.
"Who comes to disturb the slumber of the dragon god of Angorak?"
a muffled voice demanded from behind the door.
"I am Urtag, the Archpriest of Kamat."
The Grolem's voice was frightened now.
"As commanded, I bring the prisoners to the Disciple of Torak."
There was a moment of silence, then the rattling sound of an immense chain, followed by the grating of an enormous bolt. Then, slowly, creakingly, the door opened. Tenedra gasped. Standing in the doorway was Belgarath. It was a moment before her startled eyes began to sort out the subtle differences that informed her that the white-haired man before her was not indeed the old sorcerer, but rather someone who looked so much like him that they could easily pass for brothers. Subtle though the differences were, they were the nonetheless profound. In the eyes of the man in the doorway there was a haunted look, a look compounded of grief and horror, and a dreadful self-loathing, all overlaid with the helpless adoration of a man who has given himself utterly to a dreadful master.
"Welcome to the tomb of the one-eyed god, Pogala,"
he greeted the sorceress. "It has been a long time, Belzedar," she replied in an oddly neutral voice.
"I have given up the right to that name,"
he told her, and his tone was faintly regretful.
"It was your decision, Zadar,"
he shrugged.
"Perhaps. Perhaps not. Maybe what I'm doing is also necessary."
He pushed the door open wider.
"Come inside, if you will. This crypt is habitable, if only barely."
He looked directly at Urtag then.
"You have performed a service, Urtag, Archpriest of Torak, and a service should not be unrewarded. Come."
And he turned and led them back into the vaulted chamber beyond. The walls were of stone, massive blocks set without mortar, and bolted to the topmost tier were a great iron arches, supporting the ceiling and the immense ruin above them. The great chill of masses of cold stone and iron was held off by large glowing braziers set in each corner. In the center of the room stood a table and several chairs, and along one wall lay a cluster of loosely rolled pallets and a neat stack of gray woolen blankets. On the table stood a pair of large candles, their flame unwinking, steady in the dead air of the tomb. Zadar paused briefly at the table to pick up one of the candles, then led them across the flagstone floor to an arched alcove set in the far wall.
"Your reward, Urtag," he said to the Grolem. "Come, behold the face of your god."
He lifted the candle. Lying upon its back on a stone bier, within the alcove, lay a huge figure, robed and cowled in black. The face was concealed by a polished steel mask. The eyes of the mask were closed. Urtag took one terrified look, then prostrated himself on the floor. There was a deep, rasping sigh, and the recumbent figure in the alcove moved slightly. As Tenedra stared in horrified fascination, the vast, steel-covered face turned restlessly toward them. For a moment, the polished left eyelid opened. Behind that eyelid burned the dreadful fire of the eye that was not. The steel face moved, as if it were flesh, twisting into an expression of contempt at the priest groveling on the flagstones, and a hollow murmuring came from behind the polished lips. Urteg started violently, and raised his suddenly stricken face, listening to the hollow muttering which he alone in the dim crypt could hear clearly. The hollow voice continued, murmuring in Urtag's ears. The archpriest's face drained as he listened, and a look of unspeakable horror slowly twisted his features. The hollow muttering droned on. The words were indistinct, but the inflections were not. Desperately, Zinedra covered her ears. Finally, Urteg screamed and scrambled to his feet. His face had gone absolutely white, and his eyes were starting from their sockets. Gibbering insanely, Urteg fled, and the sound of his screams echoed back down the iron stairway as he ran in terror from the ruined tower. Chapter 20. The whispering had begun almost as soon as Belgarath, Silk, and Geryon reached the coast of Meloria. It was indistinct at first, little more than a sibilant breath sounding perpetually in Geryon's ears. But in the days that followed, as they moved steadily south, occasional words began to emerge. The words were the sort to be reckoned with. Home, mother, love, and death. Words upon which attention immediately fastened. Unlike the land of the Morindum, which they had left behind, northernmost Meloria was a land of rolling hills covered with a tough-stemmed, dark-green grass. Occasional nameless rivers wound among those hills, roiling and turbulent beneath a lead-gray sky. They had not seen the sun for what seemed like weeks. A sort of dry overcast had moved in off of the Sea of the East, and a stiff breeze, chill and smelling of the polar ice, pressed continually at their backs as they moved southward. Belgarath now rode with extreme caution. There was no sign of that half-doze that was his custom in more civilized parts of the world, and Geryon could feel the subtle push of the old man's mind as he probed ahead for any hidden dangers. So delicate was the sorcerer's searching that it seemed only a slowly expiring breath, light, tentative, concealed artfully in the sound of the breeze passing through the tall grass. Silk also rode warily, pausing frequently to listen and seeming on occasion to sniff at the air. Often he would even go so far as to dismount and put his ear to the turf to see if he might pick up the muffled tread of unseen horses approaching. "Nervous work," the little man said as he remounted after one such pause. "Better to be a little overcautious than to blunder into something," Belgarath replied. "Did you hear anything?" "I think I heard a worm crawling around down there," Silk answered brightly. "He didn't say anything, though. You know how worms are."
"Do you mind?"
"All you did ask, Belgarath."
"Oh, shut up."
"You heard him ask, didn't you, Geryon?"
"That is probably the most offensive habit I've ever encountered in anyone," Belgarath told the little thief.
"I know," Silk answered. "That's why I do it. Infuriating, isn't it? How far do we have to go before we come to woods again?"
"Several more days. We're still a goodly distance north of the tree line. Winter's too long and summer too short for trees to grow up here."
"Boring sort of a place, isn't it?" Silk observed, looking around at the endless grass and the rounded hills that all looked the same.
"Under the circumstances, I can stand a little boredom. The alternatives are not all that pleasant."
"I can accept that." They rode on, their horses wading through the knee-high gray-green grass. The whispering inside Geryon's head began again.
"Hear me, child of light."
That sentence emerged quite clearly from the rest of the unintelligible sibilance. There was a dreadfully compelling quality in that single statement. Geryon concentrated, trying to hear more. "I wouldn't do that," the familiar dry voice told him.
"What?"
"Don't do what it tells you to do."
"Well, who is it?"
"Torek, of course. Who did you think it was?"
"He's awake?"
"Not yet. Not fully, at any rate. But then he's never been entirely asleep, either."
"What's he trying to do?"
"He's trying to talk you out of killing him."
"He's not afraid of me, is he?"
"Of course he's afraid. He does not know what's going to happen any more than you do. And he is just as frightened of you as you are of him."
That immediately made Geryon feel better.
"What should I do about the way he keeps whispering to me?"
"Oh, there's not much you can do. Just don't get into the habit of obeying his orders, that's all."
They camped that evening, as they usually did, in a well-sheltered hollow between two hills. As usual, they built no fire to give away their location.
"I am getting a bit tired of cold suppers," Silk complained, biting down hard on a piece of dried meat. "This beef's like a strip of old leather."
"The exercise is good for your jaws," Belgareth told him.
"You can be a very unpleasant old man when you set your mind to it. Do you know that?"
"The nights are getting longer, aren't they?"
Geryon said, to head off any further wrangling.
Summer's winding down," Belgareth told him. "It will be autumn up here in another few weeks. Winter's going to be right on its heels."
"I wonder where we will be when winter comes,"
Geryon said rather plaintively.
"I wouldn't do that," Silk advised. "Thinking about it isn't going to help, and it's only going to make you nervous."
"Nervous, sir,"
Geryon corrected. "I'm already nervous."
"Is there such a word as nervouser?"
Silk asked Belgareth curiously.
"There is now," Belgareth replied. "Geryon just invented it."
"I wish I could invent a word," Silk said admiringly to Geryon, his ferret-like little eyes gleaming mischievously.
"Please, don't poke fun at me, Silk. I'm having enough trouble as it is."
"Let's get some sleep," Belgareth suggested. "This conversation's not going anywhere. And we have got a long way to ride tomorrow."
That night, the whispering invaded Geryon's sleep, and it seemed to convey its meaning in images rather than words. There was an offer of friendship, of a hand outstretched in love. The loneliness that had haunted his boyhood from the moment he had discovered that he was an orphan seemed to fade, to pass somehow behind him with that offer, and he found himself rather desperately wanting to run toward that hand reaching toward him. Then, very clearly, he saw two figures standing side by side. The figure of the man was very tall and very powerful, and the figure of the woman was so familiar that the very sight of her caught at Geryon's heart. The tall, powerful man seemed to be a stranger, and yet was not. His face went far beyond mere human handsomeness. It was quite the most beautiful face Geryon had ever seen. The woman, of course, was not a stranger. The white lock at the brow and the glorious eyes were the most familiar things in Geryon's life. Side by side, the beautiful stranger and Aunt Paul reached out their arms to him.
"You will be our son," the whispering voice told him. "Our beloved son. I will be your father, and Bulgara your mother. This will be no imaginary thing, child of light, for I can make all things happen. Bulgara will really be your mother, and all of her love will be yours alone. And I, your father, will love and cherish you both. Will you turn away from us and face again the bitter loneliness of the orphan child? Does that chill emptiness compare with the warmth of loving parents? Come to us, Belgarion. Accept our love."
Geryon jerked himself out of sleep, sitting bolt upright, trembling and sweating.
"I need help," he cried out silently.
reaching into the vaults of his mind to find that other nameless presence.
"What's your problem now?"
the dry voice asked him.
"He's cheating," Geryon declared, outraged. "Cheating? Did somebody come along and make up a set of rules while I was not watching?"
"You know what I mean. He's offering to make Aunt Paul my mother if I'll do what he says."
"He's lying. He cannot alter the past. Ignore him."
"How can I? He keeps reaching into my mind and putting his hand on the most sensitive spots."
"Think about Tsinedra. That will confuse him."
"Tsinedra?"
"Every time he tries to tempt you with Polgara, think about your flighty little princess. Remember exactly how she looked when you peeked at her while she was bathing that time back in the Wood of the Dryads."
"I did not peek."
"Really? How is it that you remember every single detail so vividly, then?"
Geryon blushed. He had forgotten that his daydreams were not entirely private.
"Just concentrate on Tsinedra. It will probably irritate Torak almost as much as it does me."
The voice paused.
"Is that all you can really think about?"
it asked then. Geryon did not try to answer that. They pushed on southward under the dirty overcast, and 2 days later they reached the first trees, scattered sparsely at the edge of the grassland where great herds of antlered creatures grazed as placidly and as unafraid as cattle. As the three of them rode south, the scattered clumps of trees became thicker, and soon spread into a forest of dark, bowed evergreens. The whispering blandishments of Torak continued, but Geryon countered them with thoughts of his red-haired little princess. He could sense the irritation of his enemy each time he intruded these daydreams upon the carefully orchestrated images that Torak kept trying to instill in his imagination. Torak wanted him to think of his loneliness and fear, and of the possibility of becoming a part of a loving family. But the intrusion of Tsinedra into the picture confused and baffled the god. Geryon soon perceived that Torak's understanding of men was severely limited, concerned more with elementals, with those towering compulsions and ambitions which had inflamed him for the endless aeons. Torak could not cope with the scattered complexities and the conflicting desires that motivated most men. Geryon seized on his advantage to thwart the insidious and compelling whispers with which Torak tried to lure him from his purpose. The whole business was somehow peculiarly familiar. This had happened before. Not perhaps in exactly the same way, but very similarly. He sorted through his memories, trying to pin down this strange sense of repetition. It was the sight of a twisted tree stump, lightning blasted and charred, that suddenly brought it all flooding back in on him. The stump, when seen from a certain angle, bore a vague resemblance to a man on horseback, a dark rider who seemed to watch them as they rode by. Because the sky was overcast, the stump cast no shadow, and the image clicked into place. Throughout his childhood, hovering always on the edge of his vision, Geryon had seen the strange, menacing shape of a dark-cloaked rider on a black horse, shadowless, even in the brightest sunlight. That had been Asherak the Murgo, of course, the Grolem whom Geryon had destroyed in his first open act as a sorcerer. But had it? There had existed between Geryon and that dark figure which had so haunted his childhood a strange bond. They had been enemies. Geryon had always known that. But in their enmity there had always been a curious closeness, something that seemed to pull them together. Geryon quite deliberately began to examine a startling possibility. Suppose that the Dark Raider had not, in fact, been Asherak. Or, if it had been, suppose that Asherak had somehow been suffused by another more powerful awareness. The more he thought about it, the more convinced Geryon became that he had stumbled inadvertently across the truth of the matter. Torak had demonstrated that even though his body slept, his awareness could still move about the world, twisting events to his own purposes. Asherak had been involved, certainly, but the dominating force had always been the consciousness of Torak. The dark god had stood watch over him since infancy. The fear he had sensed in that dark shape that had hovered always on the edge of his boyhood had not been Asherak's fear, but Torak's. Torak had known who he was from the beginning, had known that one day Geryon would take up the sword of the Raven King and come to the meeting that had been ordained since before the world was made. Acting upon a sudden impulse, Geryon put his left hand inside his tunic and took hold of his amulet. Twisting slightly, he reached up and laid the marked palm of his right hand on the orb, which stood on the pommel of the great sword strapped across his back.
"I know you now," he declared silently, hurling the thought at the murky sky. "You might as well give up trying to win me over to your side, because I'm not going to change my mind. Aunt Paul is not your wife, and I am not your son. You had better stop trying to play games with my thoughts and get ready, because I am coming to kill you."
The orb beneath his hand flared with a sudden exultation as Geryon threw his challenge into the dark god's teeth, and the sword at Geryon's back suddenly burst into a blue flame that flickered through the sheath enclosing it. There was a moment of deadly silence, and then what had been a whisper suddenly became a vast roar.
"Come then, Belgarian, child of light," Torak hurled back the challenge. "I await thee in the city of night. Bring all thy will and all thy courage with thee, for I am ready for our meeting." "What in the name of the seven gods do you think you're doing?"
Belgaroth almost screamed at Geryon, his face mottled with angry astonishment. "Torak's been whispering at me for almost a week now," Geryon explained calmly, taking his hand from the orb. "He's been offering me all kinds of things if I'd give up this whole idea. I got tired of it, so I told him to stop."
Belgaroth spluttered indignantly, waving his hands at Geryon.
"He knows I'm coming, Grandfather," Geryon said, trying to placate the infuriated old man. "He's known who I was since the day I was born. He's been watching me all this time. We're not going to be able to take him by surprise, so why try? I wanted to let him know that I was on to him. Maybe it's time for him to start worrying and being afraid just a little bit, too."
Silk was staring at Geryon.
"He's an Arlorn, all right," he observed finally.
"He's an idiot,"
Belgaroth snapped angrily. He turned back to Geryon.
"Did it ever occur to you that there might be something out here to worry about besides Torak?"
Geryon blinked.
"Tol Mishrak is not unguarded, you young blockhead. You have just succeeded in announcing our presence to every Grolem within 100 leagues.
"I didn't think of that,"
Geryon mumbled.
"I didn't think you had thought. Sometimes I don't think you know how to think."
Silk looked around apprehensively.
"Now, what do we do?" he asked.
"We had better get out of here, as fast as our horses can carry us,"
Belgaroth said. He glared at Geryon.
"Are you sure you don't have a trumpet somewhere under your clothes?"
he asked with heavy sarcasm.
"Maybe you'd like to blow a few fanfares as we go along."
He shook his head in disgust, then gathered up his reins.
"Let's ride," he said.
Chapter 21 The aspens were stark white and motionless under the dead sky, and they rose, straight and slender, like the bars of an interminable cage. Belgaroth led them at a walk, carefully weaving his way through the endless stretches of this vast, silent forest.
"How much farther?"
Silk asked the old man tensely.
"Not much more than a day now,"
Belgaroth replied.
"The clouds ahead are getting thicker."
"You say the cloud bank never moves?"
"Never. It has been stationary since Torak put it there."
"What if a wind comes along? Would that not move it?"
Belgaroth shook his head.
"The normal rules have been suspended in that region.
For all I know, the cloud might not actually be a cloud. It might be something else.
Like what?
An illusion of some kind, perhaps. The gods are very good at illusions.
Are they looking for us?
The Grolems, I mean.
Belgarath nodded.
Are you taking steps to keep them from finding us?
Naturally. Why this sudden urge for conversation? You've been talking steadily for the last hour.
I'm a little bit edgy, Sulk admitted. This is unfamiliar territory, and that always makes me nervous. I am more comfortable when I've got my escape routes worked out in advance.
Are you always ready to run?
In my profession, you have to be.
What was that?
Garion heard it too. Faintly, somewhere far off behind them, there was a deep-toned baying. One animal at first, but soon joined by others.
Wolves? He suggested.
Belgarath's face had grown bleak.
No, not wolves.
He shook his reins, and his nervous horse began to trot, the sound of its hooves muffled by the rotting loam lying thick beneath the aspens.
What is it then, grandfather?
Garion asked, also pushing his horse into a trot.
Torax hounds,
Belgarath replied tersely.
Dogs?
Not really. They are Grolems, rather specialized ones. When the Angrex built the city, Torak decided that he needed something to guard the surrounding countryside. Certain Grolems volunteered to take on non-human shapes. The change was permanent.
I have dealt with watchdogs before, Silk said confidently.
Not like these. Let's see if we can outrun them.
Belgarath did not sound very hopeful. They pushed their horses into a gallop, weaving in and out among the tree trunks. The limbs slapped against their faces as they rode, and Garion raised his arm to ward them off as the three of them plunged on. They crested a low ridge and galloped down the far side. The baying behind them seemed to be closer now. Then Silk's horse stumbled, and the little man was almost thrown from his saddle.
"This isn't working, Belgarath," he said as the old man and Garion reined in. "This ground's too treacherous for us to keep this pace."
Belgarath held up his hand and listened for a moment. The deep-toned baying was definitely closer.
"Oh, they're outrunning us anyway," the old man agreed.
"You had better think of something," Silk said, looking back nervously.
"I am working on it."
Belgarath raised his face to sniff at the air.
"Let's keep going. I just got a whiff of stagnant water. The area's dotted with swampy places. We might be able to hide our scent if we can get into a big enough patch of water."
They moved on down the slope toward the bottom of the valley. The odor of standing water grew steadily stronger as they rode.
"Just ahead,"
Garion pointed toward a patch of brown water intermittently visible among the white tree trunks. The swamp was quite extensive, a broad patch of reeking, oily water trapped in the bottom of a thickly grown basin. Dead trees thrust up out of the water, their leafless branches seeming almost like clawed hands reaching up in mute supplication to the indifferent sky. Silk wrinkled his nose.
"It stinks bad enough to hide our scent from almost anything."
"We will see,"
Belgarath replied.
"This might throw off an ordinary dog. But don't forget that the hounds are really Grolems. They have the ability to reason, so they won't be relying on scent alone."
They pushed their reluctant horses into the murky water and began to splash along, changing direction frequently, weaving in and out among the dead tree trunks. Their horses' hooves stirred up rotting vegetation from the bottom, filling the air with an even more powerful stench. The sound of the baying hounds drew closer, filled now with an excitement and a terrible hunger.
"I think they have hit the edge of the swamp," Silk said, cocking his head to listen.
There was a momentary bafflement in the baying behind them.
"Grandfather!"
Garion cried, reining in sharply. Directly before them, knee-deep in the brown water, stood a slavering black dog shape. It was enormous, fully as large as a horse, and its eyes actually burned with a malevolent green fire. Its front shoulders and chest were massive. and the fangs protruding from its mouth were at least a foot long, curving down cruelly and dripping foam.
"We have you now,"
it growled, seeming almost to chew the words as it twisted its muzzle into speech. The voice issuing from its mouth was a rasping, tearing sound. Silk's hand instantly flashed toward one of his hidden daggers.
"Never mind," Belgareth told him. "It's only a projection, a shadow."
"It can do that?" Silk's tone was startled.
"I told you, they're Grolems."
"We hunger,"
the fiery-eyed hound rumbled.
"I will return soon with my packmates, and we will feed on man meat."
Then the shape flickered and vanished.
"They know where we are now."
Silk's voice was alarmed.
"You had better do something, Belgareth. Can't you use sorcery?"
"That would just pinpoint our location. There are other things out there as well as the hounds."
"I'd say that we'd have to chance it. Let us worry about one thing at a time. Did you see those teeth?"
"They're coming," Geryon said tensely. From far back in the swamp he could clearly hear the sound of splashing.
"Do something, Belgareth."
The sky overhead had grown darker, and the air seemed suddenly oppressively heavy. From far off there was an angry mutter of thunder. A vast sigh seemed to pass through the forest.
"Keep going," Belgareth said,
and they splashed off through the slimy brown water toward the far side of the swamp. The aspen trees on the solid ground ahead of them quite suddenly turned the silvery undersides of their leaves upward, and it was almost as if a great pale wave had shuddered through the forest. The hounds were very close now, and their braying was triumphant as they plunged through the oily, reeking swamp. Then there was a brilliant blue-white flash and a shattering clap of thunder. The sky ripped open above them. With a sound nearly as loud as the thunder, they were engulfed in a sudden deluge. The wind howled, ripping away the aspen leaves in great sheets and whirling them through the air. The rain drove horizontally before the sudden gale, churning the swamp to froth and obliterating everything more than a few feet away.
"Did you do this?"
Silk shouted at Belgareth. But Belgareth's stunned face clearly said that the storm was as much a surprise to him as it was to Silk. They both turned to look at Geryon.
"Did you do it?"
Belgareth demanded.
"He didn't. I did."
The voice which came from Geryon's mouth was not his.
"I've labored too long at this to be thwarted by a pack of dogs."
"I didn't hear a thing,"
Belgareth marveled, wiping at his steaming face.
"Not even a whisper."
"You were listening at the wrong time," the voice of Geryon's inner companion replied. "I set it in motion early last spring. It's just now getting here."
"You knew that we would need it?"
"Obviously. Turn east. The hounds won't be able to track you in all of this. Swing around and come at the city from the east side. There are fewer watchers on that flank."
The downpour continued, punctuated by ripping claps of thunder and flashes of lightning.
"How long will the rain last?"
Belgareth shouted over the noise.
"Long enough. It's been building in the Sea of the East for a week. It hit the coast this morning. Turn east."
"Can we talk as we ride?"
Belgareth asked.
"I have a great many questions."
"This is hardly the time for discussion, Belgareth. You have to hurry. The others arrived at Thal Mishrak this morning just ahead of the storm. Everything's ready there, so move."
"It's going to be tonight."
"Yes, if you get there in time. Torak's almost awake now. I think you had better be there when he opens his eyes."
Belgareth wiped his streaming face again, and his eyes had a worried look.
"Let's go,"
he said sharply. And he led them splashing off through the driving rain to solid ground. The rain continued for several hours, driven before a screaming wind. Sodden, miserable, and half-blinded by flying leaves and twigs, the three of them cantered toward the east. The baying of the hounds, trapped in the swamp, faded behind them, taking on a baffled, frustrated note as the thunderous deluge obliterated all scent from the swamp and the forest. When night fell, they had reached a low range of hills far to the east, and the rain had subsided into a steady, unpleasant drizzle, punctuated by periodic squalls of chilly, gusting wind and erratic downpours that swept in randomly off of the Sea of the East.
"Are you sure you know the way?"
Silk asked Belgarath.
"I can find it," Belgarath said grimly. "Thal Mishrak's got a peculiar smell to it."
The rain slackened into a few scattered droplets, pattering on the leaves overhead, and died out entirely by the time they had reached the edge of the wood. The smell of which Belgarath had spoken was not a sharp reek, but rather was a muted, dank compound of odors. Damp rust seemed to be a major part of it, although the reek of stagnant water was also present, and the musty scent of fungus. The overall effect was one of decay. When they reached the last of the trees, Belgarath reined in.
"Well, there it is,"
he said in a quiet voice. The basin before them was faintly illuminated by a kind of pale, sickly radiance that seemed to emanate from the ground itself, and in the center of that large depression reared the jagged, broken remains of the city.
"What's that strange light?"
Geryon whispered tensely.
Belgarath grunted. "Phosphorescence. It comes from the fungus that grows everywhere out there. The sun never shines on Thal Mishrak, so it's a natural breeding ground for unwholesome things that grow in the dark. We will leave the horses here."
He dismounted.
"Is that a very good idea?"
Silk asked him, as he too swung down from his saddle.
"We might want to leave in a hurry."
The little man was still wet and shivering.
"No," Belgarath said calmly. "If things go well, nothing in the city's going to be interested in giving us any trouble. If things don't go well, it's not going to matter anyway."
"I don't like unalterable commitments," Silk muttered sourly.
"You picked the wrong journey, then," Belgarath replied. "What we are about to do is just about as unalterable as things ever get. Once we start, there won't be any possible way to turn back."
"I still don't have to like it, do I? What now?"
"Geryon and I are going to change into something a bit less conspicuous. You are an expert at moving about in the dark without being seen or heard, but we are not that skilled at it."
"You're going to use sorcery? This close to Torak?"
Silk asked him incredulously.
"We're going to be very quiet about it," Belgarath assured him. "The shape change is directed almost entirely inward, so there isn't much noise involved anywhere."
He turned to Geryon.
"We're going to do it slowly. That spreads out what little sound there is and makes it even fainter. Do you understand?"
"I think so, Grandfather."
"I'll go first. Watch me."
The old man glanced at their horses.
"Let's move away a bit. Horses are afraid of wolves. We don't want them to get hysterical and start crashing around."
They crept along the edge of the trees until they were some distance from the horses.
"This ought to be far enough. Now, watch."
He concentrated for a moment, and then his form began to shimmer and blur. The changeover was very gradual, and for several moments his face, the wolf's face, seemed to coexist together in the same place. The sound it made was the only faintest of whispers. Then it was done, and the great silver wolf sat on his haunches.
"Now, you do it,"
he told Geryon, with that slight change of expression that is so much a part of the speech of wolves. Geryon concentrated very hard, holding the shape firmly in his mind. He did it so slowly that it seemed that he could actually feel the fur growing on his body. Silk had been rubbing dirt on his face and hands to reduce the visibility of his skin. He looked at the two wolves, his eyes questioning. Belgarath nodded once and led the way out onto the bare earth of the basin that sloped down toward the rotting ruins of Thal Mishrak. There were other shapes moving in the faint light,
prowling, snuffling. Some of the shapes had a dog smell to them. Others smelled faintly reptilian. Grolems, robed and cowled, stood watch on various hummocks and rocks, searching the darkness with their eyes and their minds for intruders. The earth beneath Geryon's paws felt dead. There was no growth, no life on this wasted heath. With Silk crouched low between them, the two wolves crept belly low toward the ruin, taking full advantage of rocky outcrops and eroded gullies. Their pace seemed excruciatingly slow to Geryon, but Belgarath paid little attention to the passage of time. Occasionally, when they passed near one of the watching Grolems, they moved but one paw at a time. The minutes dragged by as they crept closer and closer to the broken city of night. Near the shattered wall, two of the hooded priests of Torak stood in quiet conversation. Their muted voices fell clearly upon Geryon's intensely sharpened ears.
"The hounds seem nervous tonight," one of them said. "The storm," the other replied. "Bad weather always makes them edgy."
"I wonder what it's like to be a hound,"
the first Grolem mused.
"If you like, perhaps they will let you join them."
"I don't think that I am that curious."
Silk and the two wolves, moving as silently as smoke, passed no more than 10 yards from the two idly chatting guards and crept over the fallen stones into the dead city of night. Once among the ruins, they were able to move faster. The shadows concealed their movements, and they flitted among the blasted stones in Belgarath's wake, moving steadily toward the center of the city where the stump of the iron tower now reared, stark and black, toward the murky sky. The reek of rust, stagnation, and decay was much stronger, coming to Geryon's wolf-sharp nose in an almost overpowering wave. It was a gagging smell, and he clamped his muzzle shut and tried not to think about it.
"Who's there?"
A voice came sharply from just ahead of them. A Grolem with a drawn sword stepped out into the rubble-strewn street, peering intently into the deep shadows where the three crouched, frozen into immobility. Geryon sensed rather than heard or saw Silk's slow, deliberate reach toward the dagger sheathed at the back of his neck. Then the little man's arm swung sharply down, and his knife made a fluttering whistle as it sped with deadly accuracy, turning end for end as it flew. The Grolem grunted, doubling over sharply, and then he sighed and toppled forward, his sword clanging as it fell. "Let's move." Silk ran past the huddled form of the dead Grolem sprawled on the stones. Geryon smelled fresh blood as he loped past, and the smell brought a sudden hot taste to his mouth. They reached the massive tangle of twisted girders and crumpled plates that had been the iron tower and crept silently through the open doorway into the total darkness of the chamber within. The smell of rust was everywhere now. Coupled with it was a smell of ancient, brooding evil. Geryon stopped, sniffing nervously at the tainted air, feeling his hackles rising on his rough neck. With an effort, he suppressed the low growl that rose involuntarily in his throat. He felt Belgarath's shoulder brush him, and he followed the old wolf, guided now by scent alone in the utter blackness. At the far end of the huge, empty iron room, there was another doorway. Belgarath stopped, and Geryon felt again that faint brushing whisper as the old man slowly shifted back into the shape of a man. Geryon clenched in his own will and let himself gradually flow back into his own form. Silk was breathing a string of colorful curses, fervent but almost inaudible.
"What's the matter?" Belgarath whispered.
"I forgot to stop for my knife," Silk replied, grating his teeth together. "It is one of my favorites." "What now, grandfather?"
Geryon asked, his whisper hoarse.
"Just beyond this door, there is a flight of stairs leading down."
"What's at the bottom?"
"A cellar. It is a sort of tomb, where Zadar's got Torak's body. Shall we go down?"
Geryon sighed, then squared his shoulders.
"I guess that's what we came for," he replied.
Chapter 22.
You don't actually believe I'll accept that, do you, Zadar?
Geryon froze in the act of putting his hand on the iron door at the foot of the stairs.
You can't evade your responsibility with the pretense of necessity, the voice beyond the door continued.
Aren't we all driven by necessity, Polgara?
A stranger's voice replied, with a kind of weary sadness.
I won't say that I was blameless, but wasn't my apostasy predestined? The universe has been divided against itself since the beginning of time. And now the two prophecies rush toward each other for their final meeting, when all will be resolved. Who can say that what I have done was not essential to that meeting?
That is an evasion, Zadar. What's she doing here?
Geryon whispered to Belgarath.
She's supposed to be here,
Belgarath whispered back, with an odd note of satisfaction.
Listen. I don't think we'll gain anything by wrangling with each other, Polgara,
Zadar the Apostate was saying.
We each believe that what we did was right. Neither of us could ever persuade the other to change sides at this point. Why don't we just let it go at that?
Very well, Zadar,
Aunt Paul replied coolly.
What now?
Silk breathed.
There should be others in there, too,
Belgarath answered softly.
Let's make sure before we go bursting in.
The iron door in front of them did not fit tightly, and faint light seeped through the cracks around the frame. Geryon could make out Belgarath's intent face in that dim light.
"How's your father?"
Zadar asked in a neutral tone.
"About the same as always. He is very angry with you, you know."
"That was to be expected, I suppose."
"He has finished eating, Lady Polgara,"
Geryon heard Zenedra saying. He looked sharply at Belgarath, but the old man put one finger to his lips.
"Spread one of those pallets out for him, dear," Aunt Paul instructed, "and cover him with some blankets. It is very late, and he's sleepy."
"I'll do that,"
Durnik offered.
"Good," Belgarath breathed. "They are all here."
"How did they get here?"
Silk whispered.
"I haven't the faintest idea, and I'm not going to worry about it. The important thing is that they are here." "I'm glad you were able to rescue him from Tuchik,"
Zadar said.
"I grew rather fond of him during the years we spent together."
"Where did you find him?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"We have never been able to pin down what country he is from."
"I forgot precisely,"
Zadar answered, and his voice was faintly troubled.
"Perhaps it was Kamar, or Tolhanath, or maybe some city on the other side of Meloria. The details keep slipping away from me, almost as if I weren't supposed to examine them too closely."
"Try to remember. It might be important,"
Zadar sighed.
"If it amuses you,"
he said. He paused as if thinking.
"I had grown restless for some reason. It was, 50 or 60 years ago. My studies no longer interested me, and the bickering of the various Grodom factions began to irritate me. I took to wandering about, not really paying much attention to where I was. I must have crossed and crisscrossed the kingdoms of the West and the Angrak kingdoms a half dozen times in those years. Anyway, I was passing through some city somewhere when the idea struck me all at once. We all know that the orb will destroy anyone who touches it with the slightest trace of evil in his heart. But what would it do to someone who touched it in total innocence? I was stunned by the simplicity of the idea. The street I was on was full of people, and I needed quiet to consider this remarkable idea. So I turned a corner into some forgotten alley, and there the child was, almost as if he had been waiting for me. He seemed to be about 2 years old at the time, old enough to walk, not much more. I held out my hand to him and said, 'I have a little errand for you, my boy.' He came to me and repeated the word, 'errand.' It is the only word I've ever heard him say.
What did the orb do when he first touched it?
And Paul asked.
It flickered. In some peculiar way, it seemed to recognize him. Something seemed to pass between them when he laid his hand upon it.
He sighed then.
No, Polgara. I do not know who the child is, or even what he is. For all I know, he may even be an illusion. The idea to use him in the first place came to me so suddenly that I sometimes wonder if perhaps it was placed in my mind. It is entirely possible, I suppose, that I didn't find him, but that he found me.
He fell silent again. There was a long pause on the other side of the iron door.
Why, Zadar?
Aunt Paul asked him very quietly.
Why did you betray our master?
Her voice was strangely compassionate.
To save the orb,
he replied sadly.
That was the idea at first, at least. From the moment I first saw it, it owned me. After Torek took it from our master, Belgrath and the others began making their plans to regain it by force. But I knew that if Aldor himself did not join his hand with theirs to strike directly at Torek, they would fail. And Aldor would not do that. I reasoned that if force must fail, then guile might succeed. I thought that by pretending allegiance to Torak, I might gain his confidence and steal it back from him.
What happened, Zadar?
Her question was very direct. There was another long, painful pause.
Oh, Palgra.
Zadar's voice came in a strangled sob.
You cannot know. I was so sure of myself. So certain that I could keep a part of my mind free from Torak's domination. But I was wrong. Wrong. His mind and will overwhelmed me. He took me in his hand and he crushed out all of my resistance.